What I want you to walk away with after this talk is understanding a bit more about the concept of what really is being used rather pervasively, and that is the concept of public health emergencies. We'll try to define it and actually use complex emergencies that have been with us for the last third of the 20th century to define this a bit better, and talk a bit about the epidemiology that we've seen in war and conflict and developed and smoldering country models, and where we get to be tied up with the direct effects of these crises. It's really the indirect effects for the long term, attribute most to the mortality and morbidity, especially for children and women. And if we have a few moments at the end, look at sort of the common thread that we're beginning to see more and more throughout the world of public health emergencies. So they are crises or disasters that adversely impact the public health systems, but also the infrastructure. And typically we think, certainly in war and conflict, the protective infrastructure that apply to water, sanitation, shelter, food, and health. But the protective threshold can be destroyed, as in war and conflict, but it's also can be overwhelmed in a large-scale natural disaster, certainly not recovered after war and conflict. Health systems tend to be the first to be destroyed during war and conflict and the last to be rehabilitated. And sometimes, or quite often, especially with the complex emergencies of the last third of the 20th century, denied to a number of ethnic, religious, or other groups and only to them. Public health emergencies can occur in any kind of large-scale war and conflict, and so we'll talk about the complex emergencies, as I said, but also large-scale natural disasters, as we saw in Katrina and Indian Ocean. And anytime we have a pandemic, it is, by nature, a public health emergency, because there really is no place in the world that has the assets and the resources to handle what we now know would be a large-scale pandemic. Complex emergencies, politically motivated, with high levels of violence, especially towards civilians. Few people recognize the fact that there's actually been more deaths from these complex emergencies in the 20th century than the cross-border wars of World War II, World War I, and the Korean War. The UN Charter in 1945 was written to deal with cross-border wars. So it has very little applicability to complex emergencies, and indeed public health infrastructure and genocide and other issues cannot be found in the UN Charter. So there is an ongoing political debate, exactly what do we do to fill this void, and the humanitarian community tends to be there to pick up the pieces and fill in the gaps. The direct effects that we see and hear about in the media are primarily to the deaths and the injuries and human rights abuses and the psychological problems and disabilities, but for the most part, majority of mortality and morbidity come from the indirect effects. The population displacement, disruption of food, loss of public health infrastructure and health facilities, and destroyed livelihoods. But also, inextricably, it's the inequities and the poverty all the way through to oppression and religious fundamentalism that all adversely influence the public health and result with high levels of mortality and morbidity. So we'll just look into a couple of these models. The developing country model, most of the ones we think about right up front are those that come from Africa and Angola, Somalia, Liberia, Congo. Developing country model, former Yugoslavia, Iraq, Chechnya, and the chronic smoldering country models that have been going on for up to 55, almost 60 years now in Haiti, Sudan, Palestine, and a few others. The internal conventional wars of the latter third of the 20th century. The goal really for insurgents or rebels was to control territory and control resources. There are some complex emergencies in which the wars have been directed really just to control water, for example, so alone. And that, as you well know, continues to be a major problem in Palestine. The developing country model, the health profile, we always see severe malnutrition, but acute malnutrition usually, outbreaks of communicable diseases, very high crude mortality rates, and indeed if they're disaggregated, we see high levels for underage 5 mortality rate, and certainly women, and high case fatality rates. So, you know, where we have a measles mortality rate in the developed world of less than 1%, in Africa, mortality from measles can be up to about 80%. And again, starting off with no public health infrastructure. And the chronic smoldering country models like Sudan, children grow up chronically malnourished. They really know only a culture of violence, little access to health care and education. Really, there's a struggle going on all the time just to sustain basic health services. And if there are healthcare workers, they are usually expatriate healthcare workers. And reproductive health in all aspects of it, including just ketamine for C-sections, is considered a luxury. Haiti, as one example, is a bit different, but health problems similar to the U.S. at the turn of the 1900s, except for HIV/AIDS. But you must also consider in these that environmental degradation is extremely high. So in Haiti, for example, compared to Dominican Republic, which is still part of the same island, the forested areas are down now to about 2%. And when a hurricane goes through, it may kill 15, 20 people, but because there's no root structure left anymore in those situations, always up to about 3,000 or so people die from the consequences of mudslides and others. So really, is this a developmental kind of emergency or emergency situation? So there's always a mixture of things. In the developed country model like Iraq and former Yugoslavia, they occur really in relatively healthy populations with similar demographics profiles from the Western countries. But what we see, because all of these countries had economies that could afford advanced weaponry, so we tend to see large trauma mortality rates. But also because we have an elderly population, excess mortality from untreated now chronic diseases like strokes and diabetes, and undernutrition, really not so much in the children, but mostly in the elderly, and of course rape, psychological traumatic exposures, but very, very few epidemics compared to the developing country model. Now, recently, and the two examples are Iraq and Afghanistan, so what we call unconventional or asymmetrical warfare, the goals are not for resources and territory, but really to control a population. The emphasis being on ethnic, religious, and tribal kind of survival. This comes from an article published in The Lancet, but it illustrates in a Venn diagram the three components. The asymmetrical or unconventional warfare, which really all the attention has been directed towards that part of the Venn diagram. At the same time, there's been pervasive insecurity. We do not have a humanitarian space or a front line that we normally saw in the conventional complex emergencies. And as these go on, they produce a prolonged public health emergency. So indeed, the situation with water, electricity, and others are actually worse now than they were at the beginning of the conflict. So that's the nature of these events. Also with it, increasing attacks on the humanitarian community. So in 2007, attacks were up an unprecedented 150%. And in 2008, ending in June, NGOs already 63 deaths and 25 deaths among UN agency personnel. These are highly militarized and politicized responses, so there's been a diminishing influence and the inclusion, as you all know, of the conventional humanitarian community. In April 2004, so about a year after the war started, was the first time that any surveillance was begun. And that's, as you all know, a basic infrastructure part of the system. And about 18 months then after, in October 2004, an obscure report came out from the Ministry of Health in Iraq that already public health was a major concern and more deaths were from inadequate health services than from the violence, something that obviously was not reported in the media. So just two examples, Oxfam, the report, the chronic malnutrition rate gone up from about 18% to now 28%. And the infant mortality rate, which actually was quite acceptable in that area, but now it shares along with Afghanistan, Liberia, and Sierra Leone as the four highest death rates worldwide. And as we all know, the infant mortality rate is less a reflection on antenatal, perinatal kind of care, but it's a composite of governance, transportation, education, a whole bunch of things that allow the infant mortality rate to be acceptable in any countries. So it's the direct consequences that are actually rarely go above 10 to 14%, but they get all the attention. But when the, soon after the violence starts, the indirect effects continue to go up, and we have what's called a decay function that may extend up to 10 years and not come back to the baseline for a decade. In one study in Central Africa, the indirect deaths during the conflict was about 71%, and the 6 months transition after the shooting stopped up to 83%, and in this situation dropped down to about 45% in 4 years. And again, both in the direct and the indirect, most of the victims are women and children and mental health problems. If you remember the controversy about the Iraq mortality study from Johns Hopkins, but it's well recognized in war zones that we only keep data on deaths that are witnessed and where people like the media go. There are tremendous amounts of biases and political pressures about these statistics, but the media, which is often the only source, probably picks up no more than about 30%. And under very violent conditions, about 5%. And so it's much worse than is usually reported. The common thread of public health emergencies, just to give you some examples, that's quite honestly very similar to what we see in war and conflict. Post-Katrina, we did this study a year after the hurricane, and if you recall, all the surveillance in New Orleans was done on paper, all flooded, so turned into pulp, so there was no longer any baseline epidemiology, but it was the citizenry in New Orleans who reported that they were reading more obituaries than ever, and reported then to now the fledgling existence of the public health system. And so we did a study that showed that a year after Katrina, there was a 47% increase in mortality over the baseline. And in the Indian Ocean tsunami, which of course has had more robust funding than ever, is still coming in. That doesn't mean it goes to the right areas, but 2 years post-tsunami, tremendous gaps in shelter, sanitation, potable water, health facilities, and healthcare workers throughout. So it becomes a public health emergency for the long term, again, with large numbers of indirect deaths and morbidity. The common thread in these is increasing worldwide. We have a rapid increase in the density, not only the number, but the densities of populations. So moving from rural to urban populations, about 78 million per year. We have some cities in Asia that are increasing 1 million every 6 months. If we look at who represents, especially in Africa, which is now 67% urban population, is most commonly a single or widowed female with 3 to 5 children seeking security and social services in the urban setting, not necessarily getting it, as you know. Deficient dwellings, aged infrastructure, and again, just the available infrastructure and capacity to respond to any of the crises, this we see, and as we know, that disasters keep governments honest, and so it's only when we get these large-scale disasters that it exposes the real gaps and deficiencies in the not only the public health infrastructure, but in the public health system. And then the ecological environmental changes that may occur, and Haiti is probably one of the best examples we have of that. I'm going to end with this example because this is the new humanitarian crisis that is looming, and more so now with our financial crisis. But as you know, what happened with Alma Ata and the attempt to see health and education as a human right, it failed for a number of reasons. If you remember the health indices in the 1950s, but there were certainly many improvements. But with globalization and less dominance of WHO, more dominance of the World Bank, which the mantra is if we improve the economy, everything else will follow. But it's those countries that have actually benefited the most economically that have now the greatest discrepancies between the have and the have-nots. And it's many of those populations that have obviously gone to those urban settings, have had to move into disaster-prone areas, but areas in which there really is no public health system or public health infrastructure. So the World Bank has also stated, okay, we'll provide better improved health services, but it's usually been user pay services and also education. So many of the indirect situations that we see with war, like gender-based violence, education really paid now only to have boys go to school and not girls, and increasing then their mortality, and depression and suicide and alcoholism are increasing in that situation. So we produce an invisible population with little or no representation in the humanitarian community. So quite honestly, in many of those cities that have, in countries which have benefited the most economically, have even reported recently that they've become a major health security issue. Thank you very much.
I really want to thank our speakers not only for the presentations, but for their attention to time and the possibility for questions and answers and discussion. We're not set up quite as I might wish with a microphone out there. I have a question to start our discussion, and I'm going to ask Derek, if you raise your hand, to pick up any questions that you write. And if you have a question, if you raise your hand, I will call on you, but you might need to come up to the microphone. So you have two choices. You can write a question down and hand it to Derek, or raise your hand and Derek can pick it up, or make your way to the microphone, and that way we can make sure everybody hears the question. If you want to try from your seat with a reinterpretation, we can try that as well. So that's actually a third option. But one of the things that came to mind, Barbara, when you were speaking, when you showed the dance and the art activities, was that some of the work on healing, Barbara Olberg and Pinus's work, suggests that art and music and dance, those psychomotor tasks, can be very healing. And so I really want to ask each of you, you know, about the ways, especially in this society where we're cutting back art, music, dance from public education, or in the cases of, you know, the war context, where just resources for something that seemingly frivolous might have been allocated, if you've ever seen that. So it's really for each of you to reflect on how we can make that healing strategy much more a part of what's done. And I'm afraid you guys are going to have to come to the microphone as well, because as I see, there's no additional microphones on the table. So we'll start with Barbara, and just prepare to stand up.
Very early, when we started to deal with children with severe injuries at Harlem Hospital, we worked very closely with our child psychiatrists. We have a training program in child psychiatry.
Start over. I think they're
okay.
Having trouble here.
I'll start over. In the beginning of our program, when we had such a huge number of children coming in with very severe injuries, many of them from violence.
I don't know what has happened.
Whatever. We started to work with our child psychiatry department. We have a training program. And we found that a lot of children had severe psychological issues following this type of injury. And they told us that children needed to re-find joy. Claude Chemtob, who's at Mount Sinai and who worked in Israel with children of violence, heard me speak once, and he said that in Israel they found the same thing, that children exposed to violence needed to dance, paint, play, rediscover joy in order to heal. And we know play is the work of children, so they need to play and find joy to heal from these episodes, but we also need to make our society, our cities, our communities, healthier communities for children to grow up in.
It's a nice question, Deborah. I really, because I think art means a lot to us, and yet there is kind of somehow this notion that from a utilitarian perspective, oh, it doesn't really count, it doesn't really matter. And I think, in fact, it does count. A few years ago, Deborah and I, our organizations, partnered on a national training via which we use satellite television to train leaders across the United States and to engage in basically a national leadership dialogue. And there actually was one an hour and a half piece of one of our biannual sessions, which focused on the links between art and violence. And for that, we pulled together the data, which showed the value. The data is actually very sparse because, you know, our utilitarian nature is like, why would we study something as separate or as trivial or as, you know, not serious as that? But there is limited, very, very good and very, very persuasive data. And if anybody's interested, please see me because I'm really interested in kind of going back to that research and seeing what's happening now and how to resurrect it. A program in the Northern California area where I work is called East Bay Center for Performing Arts, and it's Jordan Simmons, the director, talks with brilliance about it's not just taking a gun out of a young person's hand, but it's putting the paintbrush in their hand, and I think that, you know, says it very, very beautifully. And particularly in art, and I'll think of another example there where the young people talk about how easy it is to buy the gun in their neighborhood and how hard it is to find the apple. And so they created a video called Finding an Apple in Richmond to tell their own personal story of the trauma they face and the lack of joy and the lack of creativity. But believe me, the people engaged in that video work through that video work have a very, very different experience. And finally, I would say, and this is one of the beauties, art is not like something for kids. Art is something which has to be part of our communities. And when we create our communities and we create our neighborhoods with a sense of art, with a sense of value, with a sense of community spirit, that has an impact on everyone. It literally changes the norm. And by changes the norm, will change the outcomes we experience.
Thanks.
Yeah, just briefly, some of the most compelling art, obviously, has come out of war and post-conflict situations. Lots of examples, for example, in Yugoslavia and others. but one of the things you have to understand, at least in Africa, for example, is that it's really the healing of the community rather than the individual. And so you have to bring back art in the community and music in the community, and then everything else follows. But one of the things we do poorly is we actually bring programs in that are directed towards individuals, mm-hmm. and they often just fail because of that.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. I lived in Tanzania for 2.5 years and was able to purchase some wonderful art, and often would ask, well, who's the artist? To only to find that there was a collective of people and no signed, this is my piece of art. So it's a very interesting notion when you think about interventions from that perspective, what it needs to do. I also think about Stephen Canetto in Columbus, Ohio, who started Art Safe, which is actually designed to help people with mental illness in their healing, but has grown to really deal with this issue of surviving violence in particular. I think from Carl Bell's work, we get a very good sense of the intersection of being victimized and the mental illness. So it's an interesting way that I think public health might underrepresent a very powerful strategy for many that we serve and for prevention.
And there's another piece of that I'm wondering, very related, whether how many people in the audience here have heard of digital storytelling? About a third of the people talk to one another about it, but basically digital storytelling is a methodology of using the computer to tell your personal story. And in particular, it's been used in family violence situations as part of the recovery, and is used in a number of shelters and other battering counseling programs around the United States, where people have a way, through expressing their personal story and then sharing it in some cases with others, and in other cases not sharing it at all, but through a combination of photographs and music and words and whatever you can put. Typically a digital story is 2 minutes. It probably takes 2 days to produce, and many people I've spoken to have described it as one of the most healing efforts they've been engaged in, similar to the mental health issues you're describing, Deborah.
Any other questions or comments? We have a couple here. Do you want to come up or try to?
Oh, I think I love it. Okay,
and I can try to repeat it if, yeah. Sure. So the question is, the panelists mentioned that violence prevention is local, and the request is for a small example of a local policy that would get a community started in violence prevention. Is that it?
Okay. Long time ago, a very wise man from the Detroit Department of Parks, after the riots in Detroit, told me that violence is a negative leisure activity. So the policy change is that every child, regardless of their financial assets, should have quality after school programs and quality sports programs to give them positive leisure activity to eliminate the negative.
When you first asked that question, I kind of thought it was a hard question and couldn't think of the answer. And immediately, one of my favorite solutions came up, which we're finding has a lot of resonance in different communities, which is really the notion of putting a violence prevention lens or a violence prevention screen on what goes on in a variety of different sectors. And as a policy, I would say, within government, the mayor, in our case in California, we're asking the governor to bring together basically at a cabinet level all key agencies and departments and say, what can you do differently to contribute to prevention? What can you do differently to contribute to violence prevention? The library example I mentioned before was a good one. A couple of weeks ago, while speaking on chronic disease prevention in Tacoma, the head of the Tacoma YMCA came up to me He's working on a project, not on violence prevention, but on nutrition and activity. But it's a great violence prevention project. And what the Y decided to do as a partner is in one major part of the Tacoma area, which is a community, a neighborhood and region, a part of Tacoma with a lot of violence. All teenagers have been given free Y memberships for the next period of months, which I think is exactly what you're describing as, you know, let's give people a positive leisure activity. What does economic development do? What in a place like Oakland where we have a large port, what does the port do differently about violence prevention? What does the library do? What does the health department do? What does criminal justice do? What does social service do? I'll just stop with those 11 examples.
And I would add, while Dr. Burkle is coming up, one of the things that is often required of children is that they bring a parent to sign up for a particular activity. And those children who are most at risk often aren't able to get an adult, a parent, to come with them to sign them up. And figuring out creatively how to reach out beyond the rather rigid guidelines that we have for engaging children has to be a part of what a local community can really do, whether it's a temporary surrogate or some special, you know, way of signing up kids. But often the kids who need the services most are left out because they don't have that resourceful, engaged adult who brings them and signs them up and takes that level of responsibility.
Well, I come from a different world. I wish there were some things like that in parts of the world. And I've only done international health, so I've never done anything domestically. Apologize. But where to start? Well, I tell you, when we reflect on what we see, you know, we're getting increasing numbers of disaffected youth. And if they're not allowed to experience their childhood and youth and get education, they all get very angry for good reason. So I think the motives are a bit different, and their role models aren't that good. So I think primarily, I'm going to have to say I don't have anything positive to add, but look, I'm 69 years old, and I will tell you that the state of health for women and children now than what I started 40 years ago is much worse. And the indices are worse. And I was talking about the health indices in the 1950s. Well, we are beginning to see the same things now. So we're seeing such a division now between the haves and the have-nots, and the violence that I see and have to deal with come from those disaffected groups, which is a totally different situation. It's what you see on steroids, I'm afraid. So I don't have an answer. I wish there was a positive thing.
Yeah. I can offer one example that comes out of Tanzania. The organization is called WAMATA, W-A-M-A-T-A, started by Teresa Kaigaje, who has actually gone on from founding WAMATA, which is about 15 years old now, as a self-help organization around women with HIV, to get her doctorate from the University of Pittsburgh recently. So Teresa represents a very hopeful model out of a very difficult situation. She's a woman that has not been individually affected with the virus or the disease, but obviously in her family and in her community, because of the prevalence of HIV, had been affected and started this organization. And one of the things that I witnessed was on every first Saturday when the entire group gathered. Each Saturday was divided into their geographic clients, but on the first Saturday, everyone gathered. People walked a couple of hours in some cases, took several buses to gather there, and it was a gathering of 100-plus people, including their children. And as a result, WMATA had started a children's program because the children were there when the adults were involved. And interestingly, when Larry Summers was Secretary of the Treasury here, he visited Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and actually visited WMATA and had a very interesting conversation with the children about the dollar bill and what it was in the United States. So there's a little bit of hope. It comes in that same way, local leadership who is able to access some resources, individual and otherwise. And in the case of Teresa, you know, she accessed the resources of the international community in Dar to help her start WMATA. And then they started focusing on the children because they were obviously there. But I think this notion that as health providers, as public health providers, we ought look for those leaders locally who can help or who we can help as they try to develop the policy and the organizations is just a tried and true strategy across the world. If we go in to be the leader, well, not as effective as if we can find the local leadership or support the local leadership. And that includes government in some situations. And I know internationally people are quite skeptical of some of the more corrupt governments in developing countries. But there are 16 sub-Saharan African countries with early democracies and you know, governments worth our attention, and we tend to be apolitical as well. But if you're working in those contexts, it's probably worth knowing where there is a government that is making an effort to take care of some of its people. Uganda is a place that's not one of those 16 democracies, but has made a major commitment to HIV prevention and has statistics to show it. So I would just put a plug in for, not just domestically, but internationally, our real focus on who are some of the local leaders, and sometimes the children turn out to be the potential local leaders with which we can work. Yes.
I have been very immersed in the implementation of the Mental Health Services Act here in California.
Hold on one second. I'm going to try to repeat so that everybody gets the context. So she said that she has been immersed in the implementation of the Mental Health Services Act in California. So local programs currently are starting to work on their programs, that their prevention programs as part of this act.
So I was wondering
if you have any suggestions for some of us working on the county planning process. And the question is suggestions for those working on the county planning process. That sounds like a California question.
Yeah. Well, I have a background in mental health, and actually out of my mental health work started to do violence prevention as part of it. There's no question that there are links between mental health and violence prevention, and there are a number of communities that have expressed at least some interest in violence prevention strategy being part of mental health strategy. In fact, at a planning conference for this funding about a year and a half ago, to talk about what mental health prevention strategy should look like. And this funding, while it's California-specific funding, I think applies to what do we do with our mental health work around the United States. At that strategy session of local mental health leaders, Deborah was the keynote speaker speaking about violence prevention at a San Francisco-based meeting. I think in as many communities as we can, we need to get violence on the agenda and make prevention part of the solution as part of the mental health work. We'd love to play a role in that. We'd love to kind of encourage trainings, see if we can develop a peer support or leadership network of different groups. Mental health, for the most part, has been kept separate from violence prevention and from community health. It really has been talking just about a couple of mental illnesses. And I do believe that when we talk about community health, you know, safety goes to the core of that. And we'd love to see more attention paid to that issue. So we stand ready to help with that.
All right, I see one in the back there and one over here. And that'll probably be our last two. Yes. Yes. Dr. Burkle.
Yeah, I hinted at that with my last slide about globalization. Look, the World Bank is here. It's got the money. Certainly money talks, IMF, et cetera. But one of the biggest things we can do is to bring public health to the World Bank. I mean, they have for the next two decades, many, many programs, but they don't have people to do them. And I will tell you, they don't have public health aspects to them. Now, what I was talking about in terms of the globalization and the economic boon, and if you talk to them, they still feel, look, if the economy improves, everything else will follow. Well, that has not been the case. But in these countries, all the health systems have been public health facilities, public health structures, et cetera, and the educations have been essentially public funded. So when the countries see that, oh, okay, we can do something economically and they have limited funds, they take the funds from those areas and build up areas of the city or the country where new companies can come in and everything else like that. So during that time, it's taken away from the conventional ones. And so they have decreased tremendously during that time. Politically, to answer, we have to, you know, World Bank just felt that they could just switch over to this user pay kind of system immediately. It's not the case where countries have for centuries, health and education have been a public domain. That was a terrible mistake. And that's why in those places we are seeing those terrible indices. Some we haven't seen since the 1950s. So the main thing is to get politically involved with the World Bank and IMF, because they need to understand what public health is all about. It goes right over their head. They don't know what they don't know. But public health infrastructure and systems is the reason why everything is falling apart. We've produced a real monster. Now there's other issues, like we just have too many people on the face of the earth, and in many areas the density. And agricultural development has gone down. And the other thing, too, you might want to read Foreign Affairs, the latest issue, about really how USAID has disassembled. I was the Deputy Assistant Administrator for Global Health there, so I will tell you that it's a tragedy. But right now, we do not have a system in the United States to provide good aid and development to these countries. It's really, matter of fact, the Department of Defense provided $100 million to the USAID State Department so that they could do some of the stability kinds of operations. So we've gone in the wrong direction. We have to bring back the old USAID. We have to develop a new structure. Right now, it's just too chaotic. Everybody has a piece of the pie. And quite honestly, it's not working at all from the U.S. side internationally. Not at all.
So maybe our federal approach to our international relationships will change. One last question here.
Just a comment on that last piece. A really good paper to read is at the World Health Organization's website on the Social Determinants Commission. Their initial paper, which was the rationale of the commission, links the World Bank, IMF, and the policies of the Reagan era to the current health condition. Outstanding historical perspective. But my question has to do with your strategy, which was really wonderful at the various cities. Levels, and I know they're comprehensive, they're not stratified. Now I work in health services for Head Start, and I'm seeing kids in last year in San Francisco had four children had deaths from violence in the family, so it's really impacting our preschool kids. Do you have any suggestions on, what can I do as a health services person working with these families, working citywide in Oakland and San Francisco?
The question, I actually forgot to repeat it as you were going, so I'm going to try. The question is, what can he do as a health services provider for some of the trauma that children as early as preschool age are experiencing? Is that a fair? More or less, what is there?
Well, in more terms, not just the individual children, but the system and prevention and engaging.
So not just for the children, but largely at the system level to intervene and engage the community. No, I think you should come answer that, Larry. I'm moderating.
I'll be brief, and then I'll turn it over to our moderator. So because she does know a little bit about some of these questions. I mean, what strikes me is a multifold, because there are real children with real issues, and we must get responses to them. The question that the woman on the other side asked earlier about mental health and mental health services, we must insist that those kind of resources, because in this case, there are those resources there, that those resources be applied to help people after the fact. And the counseling and the helping people with what otherwise is post-traumatic stress disorder is absolutely critical. Secondly, we must change those systems so we stop doing systems with blinders on and we recognize that that's a very, very important part of the work. A couple of years ago, we developed a document for Packard Foundation which laid out the impact of violence on young children and also some of the strategies. It's on our website, preventioninstitute.org. And please give me your cards so that we can add you all to our database, and I'll give you mine. But I'd be happy to share that document with you. And most importantly, I would say, long-term, though each of those two issues I mentioned is quite important, is as an advocate, we must change the system. We must speak up from our experience and say, this is what we're seeing. It is unthinkable. It is unspeakable. We need to insist that violence prevention is an important part of the work of our communities. We must all work together on this. We all have a responsibility. Speaking from the heart, speaking about the impact on young children moves people like almost nothing else, and we must move people to behave in different ways.
Thank you. Any other?
Please continue, sir.
Well, I think Billy has a comment here. We're at the end, so Billy, you're going
to
close us out.
I wanted to say that in L.A., we looked at a comprehensive strategy, primarily for gang violence prevention, but one of the things we recommend is kids need to be free at all ages.
Hold on, Billy. Billy is saying that in L.A., They looked at a comprehensive set of strategies, and with preschool children, so preschool children in that context need to be screened and are screened, and then there's a program called Loved Ones, which really does begin to reach out to help them deal with some of that that pain and that trauma. I would just echo Larry's comments about the system needing to change, and those of us in the system, you know, we may have a small piece of the full system. Our piece is small, but if we start pushing the notion that violence is preventable and changing the policies and practices of just our part of the system, we can have a huge impact. I think for the most part, at almost every level, whether it's education, criminal justice, medical services, we still operate as if the best that we can do is respond aggressively when something tragic occurs. So I think if each of us takes this prevention perspective and applies it to our part of the system, we can make some of those larger changes that are necessary. I ask you to join me in thanking this panel for what has been a very important and well-done presentation.